University of the Air. Tonight, the second in a series of lectures on contemporary psychiatry, given by Dr. John Lovett Doust. According to Dr. Lovett Doust, there's no reason to suppose that the psychiatric disturbances seen today are any different from those of 5 centuries ago. But developments in psychiatry have resulted in different ways of regarding them and of dealing with them. Tonight, in a lecture entitled The Evolution of Contemporary Psychiatry, he traces those changing attitudes and changing methods of treatment and discusses the insights of thinkers from earliest times. Dr. Lovett Doust is professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto.
There have always existed, and perhaps always will exist, certain fears universal to mankind. Terror of the unknown, of death and loss of his identity, and of loneliness, these were as much the fears of cave-dwelling men as they are those which haunt many of us today. To attempt to counter the anxiety they engender, man laboriously constructed systems of philosophy, religious dogma, mysterious magic, and techniques of medicine. To the extent that they were successful, these beliefs and practices quelled anxiety, quenched pain, and offered acceptance through explanation and comfort through enlightenment. To the extent that they were unsuccessful, they acted as a spur in the search for more acceptable explanations, and so to the scientific bases of the medicine and the rather less scientific psychiatry we practice today. Even today, however, it's surprising how much magic is built into the behavior of our everyday lives. Although I'm sure that all of us would deny we actually believe in magic. Take superstition for one example. It's second nature, at least to some of us, not to open an umbrella in the house, to sprinkle salt over our shoulder if we spill any, to expect a third disaster after 2 previous ones. Certainly the builders of multi-story hotels today tend to number the floors so as to lead directly from the 12th to the 14th. So that no guest is forced to stay on the unlucky 13th story. Is this magic? Is it magic to utter an oath in a fit of pique? Many of us do, yet is the curse any more than a spell or incantation we cast on someone exactly as the witch or medicine man did in olden times? And what of the rabbit foot, the scarab, the penny with the hole in it that we carry about for luck? They are the modern charms and talisman of ancient magic, and they're explained by the same laws of similarity, contact, and contagion as were accepted thousands of years ago. Such laws today are contained within the very complex knowledge we now have of symbols. While a more general consideration of magic and the meaning and power of symbolic thinking would lead us too far afield at this juncture, I should like to put one question to you, and it's this. Is there any logical distinction between the behavior of one man who yawns and covers his mouth with his hand and a second man who constructs an image or clay model of a former friend and then proceeds to drive pins into the doll's body? And thirdly, a little girl who, from her assortment of playthings, chooses a baby doll, picks it up by the feet, and bangs its head over and over again against the side of her crib. To be sure, there are different ends in view. The first man wants to ensure that the devil doesn't get into his mouth, and hence into his very being, and own him as the devil owned Faustus. The second man was attempting, by imitative magic, to symbolize his enemy and capture his essence in clay, so that his real self would feel as knives the pins adroitly thrust into the image. And the child who resents the arrival of a younger brother and behaves with her doll as she would towards him, what do we say of her? Is it really being unfair to classify her behavior along with that of the shaman whose motive and deed are identical? A large part of the play therapy employed by the psychiatrist in the treatment of children today is based on observations of this order. And even if you say that grown-up people do not play with toys and dolls, I would sadly have to disagree. The toys of the grown-up child are certainly larger and more complex. They often make more noise and always cost more money. But they are toys, and they're used as toys. That is to say, as symbols representing something other than themselves. They're used by their owner to achieve status among his neighbors and make friends from among outsiders. They are for consoling loneliness, attracting or substituting for love and affection. They are the whipping boys when we need an outlet for hate, and in general, a means for transmuting dreams into at least some semblance of reality. The stage of development of the world civilizations, the culture and customs of countries, a society's relative isolation from its neighbors, or conversely, its ease of communication with people and other resources outside it, these are some of the factors responsible for differences in the ways in which man seeks to counter his universal fears. And it's probably true that present-day psychiatry takes account of these factors and of the essence of most of these beliefs, and if they work, their practices also. Let us look briefly at the history of psychiatry across the world to gain some concept of its evolution. As we see it unfold, we shall become aware of how psychiatric symptoms were regarded, and we shall also see the measures adopted to counter them, progressively first, perhaps, as magic, certainly then as religion, and finally as medicine and psychiatry. And we'll start as far back as records exist. Firstly, the East and Near East. Egypt, at the time of Imhotep, in the year 2860 BC. In Imhotep's Egypt, magic, religion, medicine and psychiatry were one and the same. The patient would report to the temple with his symptoms, and here the priest, by the laying on of hands, would allay his anxiety. The priest acted on behalf of the god, that is, he symbolized him. The patient's votive offering to the temple assuaged his guilt, and the priest would bless and so transfer magic force to a suitable charm or amulet which the patient would then carry about on his return home for an ongoing sense of security. Centuries later, the discovery of a medical papyrus tells us that the patient would speak of his troubles sometimes at great length to the priest, a method of psychotherapy as eminently practical today as it was then, both in the psychiatrist's office for the patient's symptoms and in the church also for his sins. The papyrus also suggests that the temple priest physicians recognize senile dementia, depression, hysterical reactions, and some types of alcoholic psychosis as separate diseases. Psychiatry in Mesopotamia was more loosely organized, but followed the pattern of ancient Egypt. To the Egyptian law, they added divination and the interpretation of dreams. Apparently then, as today, sin, conflict, anxiety, and guilt crept out at night, like Plato's beast, to whisper home truths so nakedly frank that they had to be clothed in symbols, that word again. And these are still truths which the waking patient cannot understand without expert help. We gather from the Bible that the ancient Hebrews were among the first peoples of history to shun the mentally ill and treat them with contempt. Ideas like original sin and the sins of the fathers being visited on their children links the illness with genetic origins and with the transcendent idea of God, devil, and rejection of the sinner. The books of Job, Ecclesiastes, and Proverbs recognize the emotional element of many physical diseases, an early insight into what we now refer to as psychosomatic affections. In ancient India, the Hindu system of Ayurvedic medicine was derived directly from their religion. For the Hindus, God was an imminent revelation within each man, and disease, both mental and physical, a manifestation of illusion due to ignorance. But for India, the greatest insights for psychiatry probably stemmed from the Buddha's attempts to reform Hinduism, and his unitary ideas, or philosophy of non-dualism, spread widely through the Far East. The impact of the non-dualism of the Buddha was felt particularly in China, where Taoism held sway until Buddhist missionaries arrived. Taoism is concerned with the play of opposites, good, bad, sun, moon, mind, body, and so on. And the clash of these two philosophies one radically separating mind and body, and the other uniting them, is reminiscent of the much later controversy of Descartes in the West. Such philosophic differences are by no means of merely theoretical relevance for medicine and psychiatry. For the dualist can see all his diseases in neat classifications, while for the monist or non-dualist, everything within the personality and the person's environment is interacting and responsible for the type and timing of the illness. Physical and emotional factors are all bound to be represented in any sickness, and to claim otherwise is specious oversimplification. Turning now to the West, we must begin with the insights and experience of the ancient Greek philosopher physicians. They attempted to derive the orderly and logical thinking of science from the supernaturalism of Homeric times. Between 600 and 430 BC, Pythagoras, Alcmaeon, Anaxagoras, and Empedocles laid a foundation for the study of the anatomy of the nervous system, physiology, and primitive biochemistry. A little later, Hippocrates could work on these. Hippocrates was equally the father of psychiatry as he was of medicine in general. He was a monist in outlook, and diagnosis delighted him. He sought facts about the illness of his patients, making precise observations of the precipitating events. He noted the personality of the patient and his heredity, the course of the illness and its modification by the environment, and the prognosis or prediction regarding its outcome. As a psychiatrist, he recognized the essential relationship between mania and melancholia, the mental changes associated with syphilis and head injury, and he commented on the occasional ability of concurrent feverish illnesses to modify certain psychiatric diseases. He seems to have been familiar with a number of neurotic conditions, and notably with hysteria, which, he wrote, was due to a wandering about of the uterus within the female body, and was curable by marriage. Epilepsy had been considered up to the time of Hippocrates as the sacred disease, and due to the visitation by the gods. Hippocrates denied this and stressed its natural causes. So outstanding was Hippocrates that he was far ahead of his time. For those who followed his psychology and psychiatry were more prone to accept tradition in speculative philosophy and biological extrapolation to man than the direct clinical observation of him. Plato, for example, accepted the sacred origin of epilepsy in 400 BC, and Aristotle, less than 100 years later, looked upon the heart as the center of thought and sensation. 20 years after Aristotle, Erasistratus reported some observations of psychophysiologic interest when he noted that the heart rate of a certain royal personage in a state of depression tended to increase when the name of the lady that he had rejected was mentioned in the conversation. The very first specialist psychiatrist was probably Asclepiades, who practiced in Rome in 90 BC. He was very much the humanitarian. He insisted on plenty of light and air and good food for his patients, devised procedures for improving their memory, and used occupational therapy and music to get their minds off their problems. Like Hippocrates, he was in advance of his times, for he spoke strongly against the use of mechanical restraints for his patients, a decision which was not popularized again for the next 1700 years. Also in Rome, at the dawn of the Christian era, were Celsus, who gave us the first description of schizophrenia, Aretaeus, who stressed the role of the patient's personality before he was sick in modifying the expression of the psychiatric disturbance, Rufus of Ephesus, who insisted on the need for a complete history-taking in psychiatry, and Galen, who died in 200 AD, whose stodgy denial of mental mechanisms and rigid theological thinking kept medicine and psychiatry alike from any advances until the end of the Middle Ages. These dark ages have been described as the demonological blanket covering the Christian world. In non-Christian parts of it, movements still occurred. Rhazes of Persia, for example, founded the first psychiatric unit in a general hospital. Maimonides, the Jewish physician of 1200 AD, was impressed by the emotional element present in physical diseases, while the Spain of the 15th century saw the establishment of the first three mental hospitals in the world. In most of Christendom at this time, however, the witch hunts were on. Spearheaded by fanatics and sanctified by the authority of Pope Pius VIII, all the age-old fear of the mentally ill flared into an unholy mission of hatred and destruction. The Witch's Hammer, the book written by two Dominican monks for the Inquisition, proved the existence of witches and told how to identify them and liquidate devils inside them. As a result, tens of thousands of hysterical neurotics, schizophrenics, and others of the mentally ill were burned alive for the alleged purification of their souls. One notorious judge sentenced 800 such women to death in the space of 16 years. And why were women selected for the blows of the witch's hammer? The two monks tell us that it was largely because they are the sex with the greater sensitivity and intuitiveness. Here's how they put it in the year 1484. Women are naturally more impressionable and more ready to receive the influence of a disembodied spirit. When they use this quality well, they are very good. But when they use it ill, they are very evil. 4 centuries later, Sigmund Freud wrote in a letter, "The medieval theory of possession is identical with our theory of the splitting of consciousness. But why did the devil who took possession of the poor victims invariably commit misconduct with them, and in such horrible ways? Why were the confessions extracted under torture so very like what my patients tell me under psychological treatment?" The Renaissance is usually known as the age of artistic and scientific creativity. In a sense, the tragic persecution, torturing, branding, and execution of witches represented a desperate attempt to do away with superstition. Unfortunately, the methods employed by Catholic and Protestant churches and the well-meaning laity alike were themselves based on superstition and mass hysteria. One wonders, with memories of European massacres of the Jews and prejudice, discrimination, and racial violence against the colored peoples of the world still vivid in our minds, whether man has really advanced much further even today. We may now hurry on through the centuries, mentioning only a few of those pioneers whose thought and work was tinder to the slumbering fires of their times. In the early 16th century, Paracelsus was one such man with scorn for the conservative medicine of his time, and Johann Weyer was one of those who responded. Weyer, Scott, Plato, and others believed that witches really were mentally ill. They began a classification of emotional and mental illnesses at the same time that Francis Bacon was laying the foundation of the scientific method, and the first mental hospitals were begun in Britain, with Bethlehem Royal in London, and in the Americas, in Mexico. In the 17th century, about the time when Leibniz was making his observations on unconscious thought processes, Harvey discovered the circulation of the blood, and Stahl was asserting that mental illness was due to interference with the function of the soul. Sydenham stated that hysteria is by far the commonest of all chronic illnesses, and it occurred in men as well as in women. With the 18th century, the literature on psychiatry began to develop into the landslide it is today. One prolific writer was Franz Mesmer, who founded mesmerism, or animal magnetism, studies which gave rise to our modern ideas of hypnosis. Although roundly criticized by his contemporaries, his investigations gave rise to a lot of experimental work in psychiatry and to psychological methods of treatment as opposed to the ducking chair and physical restraints. John Haslam in Britain was attempting to relate certain mental illnesses to disturbances within brain structure, and Benjamin Rush in the United States was employing bloodletting in some cases, tranquilization and shock treatments in others. That the tranquilizer was an immobilizing chair and the shock device a gyrating one is perhaps a detail. Near the end of the 18th century, William Tuke founded the York Retreat in England, and in France, Philippe Pinel created a similar humanitarian movement. Pinel not only succeeded in removing the chains which up to then had fettered patients, but introduced case records in the Bicêtre Mental Hospital for the first time. he commenced the so-called moral treatment of psychiatry, wherein the patient is treated as an intelligent human being capable of responding to kindness and with an expectancy that he will recover from his disability. Pinel is probably the real founder of the psychiatry we know today. With the turn of the 19th century, Franz Josef Gall was intriguing the world with his phrenology, an early attempt at localizing personality in different parts of the brain, and James Braid and Bernheim were opening new paths in the psychological treatment of the neuroses with the use of hypnosis. Charcot in Paris investigated the influence of suggestion on patients with hysteria, and Binet introduced the first intelligence test. Also in France, Janet was studying the unconscious motivations of neurotic patients and stimulating Morton Prince and William James similarly in America. The 19th century for psychiatry was a time of classification and clinical description. With the profusion of mental hospital building programs all over the civilized world, the profession of psychiatry became separated from the mainstream of medicine. It also became as isolated as were its patients, within the barred windows and towering walls of huge but lonely mid-Victorian prison palaces. From these, we are only beginning now to emancipate ourselves. Surely the old term madhouse was changed to asylum, but even this word deteriorated and no longer connoted the haven or retreat it used to mean. Rather, it carried with it the ideal of a jailhouse, and often one from which there was no return. Of course, there were reformers, angry as well as earnest ones, but such was the public need to shut away its mentally sick that the very word alienist was used officially to describe the psychiatrist of this period. And the building spree spread, with the institutions growing ever bigger and gloomier, until their separate population capacities ran from Ontario's average of 1,500 patients for Canada to 2,000 in many English counties and up to 5,000 to 6,000 in several of the states. Along with their equipment of assorted straitjackets, leather restraining muffs, chains, jointed iron leg locks, cold packs, and their padded rooms, went the ill-trained and often brutal attendants, inadequate ventilation, poor kitchens, economy budgets, and restrictive punitive legislation. To a self-righteous society, it was a crime to be mentally ill. In certain places and under certain conditions, it is still so considered. In England, 100 years ago, the searing enthusiasm for humanitarian change was sparked by John Connolly of London's Hanwell Asylum, Tuke of York, and Hill of Lincoln. In America, by Brigham of New York and by Isaac Ray. In Canada, by R.M. Buck of the Ontario Hospital, London, Daniel Clark of Toronto, and C.K. Clark of Kingston. But although each of these reformers wrought much improvement within his local hospital setting, the climate of public opinion remained uneasy. It was not to undergo any widespread change until socially minded lay people set about exposing the defects in the system and stirred the public conscience into action. And this did not commence to take place until after the turn of the century and is only just beginning to be a reality today. I don't propose in this lecture to say much of the present century and its progress. The advances gained will be apparent in the talks to follow. While we talk of changing attitudes towards the psychiatrically disabled, however, it is only fair to point out that public opinion can be influenced not only by changing social, political, and educational enlightenment, but also by the progress of scientific research. The 20th century has seen enormous impetus given and tremendous strides taken forward in medicine and its basic sciences, and psychiatry has shared in the benefits provided. From the plethora of these many advances, I shall select but two for brief mention. Firstly, some actions by our lawmakers. The 1914-18 war revealed the deplorable and inadequate state of the mental health services in many countries in the West. In Canada, under the British North America Act, mental health is a responsibility of the provinces, and efforts at reform began at the grassroots level. By the end of the Great War, a psychiatric outpatient department was opened at Toronto General Hospital, and C.M. Hinks had started a mental hygiene committee, herald of our present Canadian Mental Health Association. With the backing of his committee, Hinks began his crusade across the country, exposing overcrowding and understaffing, the uses of restraining devices, and the lack of proper medical care in provincial hospitals. By the end of the Second World War, his work had so alerted the public conscience that the national government in 1948 authorized an annual mental health grant based on population figures to each province for the purpose of invigorating their mental health programs. The wisdom of this move quickly revealed itself in a countrywide improvement in mental hospital psychiatry. It soon became apparent, however, that the amount of the grant was too small for the task it set out to accomplish. In 1955, the Canadian Mental Health Association appointed a committee on psychiatric services to look into the problem. This committee has just issued its report in a publication entitled More for the Mind, an effort paralleled in the United States in 1955 when Congress empowered a joint commission on mental illness and health to carry out a similar task. And this commission's report is entitled Action for Mental Health. Meanwhile, the Canadian House of Commons remained concerned. In 1960, the government accepted a resolution by Mr. McNaughton calling for a national survey of the extent of mental illness in Canada, its causes, problems, and methods of treatment. A year later, the appointment of a royal commission to study the health services in general provided an opportunity for the cry of mental illness to be heard. And this brings me to the second topical reference that I want to mention in the history of Canadian psychiatry. It's a very brief one and reiterates a simple, self-evident, but oft-forgotten observation. If you treat a man like a beast, he will behave towards you as a beast. If you treat him with dignity, kindness, and understanding, he will respond in similar fashion. Today, the visitor to our psychiatric hospitals would be hard put to it to discover any locked doors and barred windows, and he certainly will not find any instruments of restraint or padded rooms. And this new look is a precious one, for it wasn't true in Canada as recently as a decade ago. It is today but a signpost pointing in the direction of what still remains to be done. We've travelled today through time and across the world, glancing quickly at the superstition and magical thinking which has forced man's inhumanity to man. We have looked at the few enlightened ones who brought a message of hope through sympathy and understanding and healing comfort through medical science to the mentally sick. In the Canada of today, much remains to be done, but at least we need not be ashamed of our accomplishments.
Dr. John Lovett Dust with the second of 10 lectures on contemporary psychiatry. Dr. Lovett Dust is professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto, consultant in psychiatric research to the province of Ontario, and a member of the advisory medical board of the newly formed Ontario Mental Health Foundation. He's done a great deal of original research in his field and has made psychiatric education a special concern. Next week on University of the Air, Dr. Lovett Dust will begin a series of sketches of typical patients' histories and will deal in particular with personality disorders. The CBC Times for the week of February the 1st contains an outline of each lecture in this series. To obtain a copy, write to University of the Air, CBC, Box 500, Terminal A, Toronto.
This is the CBC Radio Network.